Truth Revolution.
Hey, welcome to
On today's Truth Revolution, we're going to be doing a rewind and giving you one of the most popular shows we did in 2017. So if we mention church service times in any rewind shows, always ignore it and go to Reva.church for the most current information.
But really, it doesn't matter to us. We just want you to know that you're welcome here at Revolution Church. We don't care what you wear. We really don't. We don't care what's been in your past. We know you've done things, thought things that you haven't told anybody about.
Because you have too.
Because I have too.
Right, and so have I.
We just know that God wants to have mercy on us for those things and wants a relationship with us. So that's what we're all about here. But hey, today we got a very special show. We love to talk about science, logic, philosophy, all those things. Today we're going to hit a whole bunch of them because we're talking to a skeptic.
Oh, yeah.
Who has written a book about Christianity.
Uh-huh. It's The Problem of God. It was written by a skeptic who became a Christian and then a pastor. And all the while exploring answers to the most difficult questions raised against Christianity, Mark Clark grew up in an atheistic home and after his father's death began a skeptical search for truth through exploring science, philosophy, and history, asking the big questions of life and eventually finding the answers in Christianity.
All right. Hey, Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
All right,
You're
all the way up in Vancouver, Canada, and we're down here in Kansas. So we're gonna bridge nations for this show today.
Right.
Hopefully, don't start an international incident here.
Good. Mark, tell us a little bit about your book, which is available right now on Amazon. The Problem of God.
Yeah.
A little bit about why you set out to write this book.
Well, I grew up in a atheistic home, as you guys already talked about, and like first time walked into a church, I was 19. The only reason I stayed was because there were girls there. So I don't know if that's like a good motivation, but anyways. But yeah, I had become a Christian late in my teen years, about 2 years before that, through a guy introducing Christ to me. I had a bit of a background and something. I grew up in a home that was like ardently atheist, like no Bible, no church, no prayer, no God. My father was such an atheist, actually, that like against this whole thing, that he, my brother, whose name is Matthew, is 4 years older than me, and he said, we have to spell his name with one T. Because we don't want to be biblical. We don't want to spell his name the same as a Bible writer, a Bible book.
That's pretty
intense.
And then
4 years later, named me Mark. So literally, I don't know, this guy didn't have a clue.
Do you have a younger brother named John?
Yeah, exactly. If I had another brother, I'd be like, oh, let's name him Luke. I think that's a good name. So anyways, no background in this, kind of against it. So I started exploring when I was about 17, 18. I'd gone to summer camp and kind of heard some of the stories and stuff, but didn't like live it out, didn't go to church or anything. And then a guy when I was about 17 in woodworking class just started telling me about Jesus, and man, you got to get your life in order. And so I started going, okay, and I started exploring it. But I'm a rational person who likes to believe things because there's evidence, like most of your listeners probably.
Oh, yeah.
We don't like to just believe stuff because it feels good.
That's right.
And actually, it didn't feel, you know, when you're 17, 18 years old in high school, Christianity doesn't necessarily feel good.
No.
Because it's like, you don't get to do whatever you want. You don't get to sleep with whoever you want and drink whatever you want and smoke whatever you want, which is what I was doing. And so it was kind of like, okay, this is actually bashing up against my life in a very real way. And so I got to figure this out. So anyway, philosophically, scientifically, psychologically, historically, and as I researched that, it became very clear to me that in the marketplace of ideas, Christianity was like, it was the most truthful, hopeful, legitimate, rational thing that a person could believe. And if that was true, I had to give my life to it and had to, you know, so Jesus kind of came up against me pretty, you know, in a pretty stark way.
Mm. So some people will say things like, well, okay, if you were an atheist, you became a Christian, it's just probably because you felt empty inside. You were looking for some meaning. Do you think that's what it was, or was there more to it than
that?
No, that's not what it was.
I was a high school kid stealing, doing drugs, you know, doing all the stuff you would, having fun. If you would have walked up to me when I was 17 and gone, you're empty, I would have been like, what are you talking about? I'm living the dream.
Yeah.
You know, so no, that wasn't it. It's like you either deal with truth or you don't.
Yeah.
And if this thing's true, if this guy really rose from the dead, then I got to reorganize my life.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's where I kind of, you know, started to go, okay, you know, some things are at stake here. And so, started, you know, accepted Christ, started just studying the Bible. Took me a long time to kind of lose most of the habits that I'd picked up from those years, you know. So when I started going to church, like literally, I think I stopped smoking maybe the year before I became a pastor.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, reading the Bible, smoking, hanging out, you know, telling people about Jesus, baptizing people out in 2 o'clock in the morning before I was baptized. Weirdly enough, I was baptizing people.
Wow.
I would preach to people in my town, and we'd go out in the water, which ecclesiologically probably isn't, you know, the best format. But anyway, I'd go out and, you know, tell people about Jesus at 2 a.m, and they'd go, okay, I want to believe, and go to Lake Ontario. I grew up outside of Toronto before I came to Vancouver, and we just baptize them and, you know, and then I started going to church a couple years later. So
That's crazy.
That is a funny story. You're baptizing them. Have you been baptized? Not yet.
Is that a thing? I don't know. That's a thing. Yeah. It wasn't until I went to church that I realized that you're not supposed to baptize people before you're baptized.
That's funny. Okay, so you in your book, though, you go over a lot of the different topics that basically you might have wrestled with logically. And then a lot of people wrestle with logically. I mean, the problem of science, the problem of God's existence, the problem of the Bible, evil and suffering, hell, sex, hypocrisy. So I just want to hit some of these. We'll get in, get out. There's a lot to talk about today, but I want to start with the problem of hypocrisy because this is huge for a lot of people.
Right. It's one of the big things that when you really boil it down to the basic point, a lot of people are just sick of the hypocrisy and they just want to find something different.
Yeah. And even if they believe in God, sometimes they avoid the church because of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. So give us a little hint about what your chapter in the book about hypocrisy is about.
Yeah, well, it goes through a bit of the classic mythology of the church is, you know, burning witches and you know, killing everybody and going on wars and all the kind of the Crusades and the Inquisition and all this stuff and saying, hey, I thought you were Christians. And so people go, I'm not going to become a Christian in 2017 because there were the Crusades. And it's like, whoa, hold on a second. That's not a thing. You can't, like, yes, we can get into the history and find out. So, A, I go into those stories and I find out what's the actual data say. And it's far less than the classic mythology actually leads you to, you know.
Yeah.
If you read like the Da Vinci Code, you know, Dan Brown says, who knows? They could have been burning 5 million witches.
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
like, well, that's like 10% of the entire population of the world.
Right.
They were very busy.
Like, yeah, they were very busy. It's like, no, that's not a thing. It's like the facts actually show, yes, there was some bad stuff, but it was a handful of people. And, you know, so it's really stopping the tape from the conspiracy theories, slowing it down. Let's get some data. Let's find out the actual facts. So that's part of the chapter. And realizing that this probably isn't as big as we thought it was. Even the political wars and the things that Christians, quote unquote, were doing, you know, throughout history. It's like, no, those were nation states doing nation state wars, but they happened to throw a cross in the front of the shields. These aren't, you know, dedicated men and women of Jesus converting people to their nation war, geopolitical wars.
Oh, yeah. And pardon my French, but there's this awesome quote that says, and I can't remember who said it for the life of me, but he says, whenever the church and the government gets together, the church becomes the government's whore.
Right.
And what he's just trying to say is like, hey, way back then or even now, when you combine government and religion, the government uses the name of God to do whatever it is they want to do.
Totally. Yeah. And so, it's like, okay, when you go back in history, you realize this is what's going on. And so let's get the actual data for the number of people that this actually affected in a negative way. Let's not let the mythology and the conspiracy theory again, let's, you know, get the numbers out of whack and then admit that, yes, this has happened. Sorry, this doesn't represent Jesus, but also recognize all throughout history there's been hypocritical Christians, people who aren't actually Christians, who claim the name of Jesus, who are self-deceived. You know, this is what Jesus taught all through the Sermon on the Mount. There's going to be people who think they're in, but they're not actually in, and they're not representing. And then, of course, we have the founder of this faith, which let's take Christianity just on what he does, not what his followers do.
Right.
Thank you.
Here's a guy who died for his enemies. Here's a guy who said, pick up the sword. So let's evaluate it, you know, as C.S. Lewis said, not on what your neighbor thinks or what you read in some book. At the end of the day, it's going to be you and God, and he's going to go, what did you do with my son. And one of the analogies I give in the book is, if we found out that Einstein was a kleptomaniac, would it mean his math is any worse? And so, yes, he's got, maybe Einstein's followers are all bad people. It doesn't mean you go, Einstein's math is wrong. You say his followers are a gong show.
Yeah.
And so let's admit we've done some stuff wrong. It's probably not as astronomical as the, you know, the mythology makes it. Let's apologize, but also let's recognize that these aren't actually, these are, there's a lot of hypocritical Christians. And so what is the actual true spirit of Christianity? And let's deal with that and then evaluate Christianity based on that. So that's what the hypocrisy chapter is about.
That's wonderful. That's really good. It's almost
It also points out.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Jeff. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it's almost like you want people to examine the facts instead of just their own assumptions.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And it also points out near the end that my church is full of, you know, I started a church about 7.5 years ago. There was literally 16 of us in my townhouse, and I knew their lives were in order and that they knew Jesus. But over the last 7.5 years, that church has grown to 5,000 people across different locations. I don't know what's going on in their lives, and I know a bunch of them are a mess. They're a disaster. Mm-hmm. So if someone looks at me and goes, oh, that guy goes to Village Church and he's doing bad things. Hypocrites. I can't believe the church is full of hypocrites. Right. It's like, well, hold on a sec. This guy's a new believer. He has no idea what's going on. And what's happened is that the gospel has come into contact with his life, and stuff started to come to the surface. He started to admit adultery. He started to admit addiction. Of course the church is full of hypocrites because it's full of messed up. It's a hospital. It's not a country club.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's admit it. It should be full of hypocrites because it's people who are dealing with the gospel affecting the kingdoms coming in their lives. And it's, you know, sins coming to the surface.
That's right. Our church is full of hypocrites too. Mm-hmm. And guess what? There's room for one more. Right. So go ahead and come on out. It's totally fine. Okay. Look, that's awesome. Let's go ahead and talk about the problem of sex. I mean, you actually cover sex in a book about why people should believe in Christianity. That's fascinating. What's going on there?
Because I've found that this is one of the massive reasons, when you get down to brass tacks, beyond the philosophy and the psychology and the history, I don't want to become a Christian because I know I'm going to be limited in who I can sleep with. Mm. I can't just have sex with whoever I want. You know, all of these real practical things about pleasure, and God is anti-sex. And so that's what people think.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write a chapter, which is probably somewhat original for a book like this, mm-hmm. to actually tackle this issue and show people, no, God is very pro-sex. This is not a situation where it's like, okay, guys, just have sex to procreate and then, you know, done and make sure the lights are off. This is a God who's like really into pleasure in the context of marriage, mm-hmm. between a man and a woman.
Yep.
He's like, man, you guys go at it.
Yeah.
And I go into Song of Solomon and Proverbs and all these beautiful biblical, this beautiful biblical picture of what sexual pleasure is. And we're talking about, so literally I've sat across from people and God, listen, this is a God who created certain anatomy, mm-hmm. that has no reproductive value. It's purely based on pleasure. Don't you want to know the God who thought that up?
Yeah.
Like, don't you want to come to know Jesus because he created this? You know,
that was his idea.
So I mm-hmm. think it has a massive, it's his idea. So it has actually a massive practical, evangelistic purpose, but also it gets into then, and through my marriage counseling that I've done over the last 15 years of my life, it gets into, you know, what does married sex actually look like? Mm. And of course, even the secular statistics say, hey, look, Friends is wrong. Seinfeld's wrong. The best sex and the most sex is being had by two people in the context of a covenant marriage.
Amen.
It's not out there playing the field.
Yeah.
That's not good sex, and they're actually not having it as much as couples who are married. And so I go into a whole thing on that.
That's awesome.
Wow.
That's really good to know. And I'm married, so of course I'm going to want to read that chapter. And I'm looking forward to that. Sorry, Dave.
It's okay. I'll just have to deal with it.
Dave's single, so. All right. So, but, you know, it really is true. God is the God who invented sex. That was his idea.
Right.
He wants it to be pleasurable, enjoyable, but he's got some parameters that he designed for maximum pleasure. And so that it's important. All right, we're going to come back. We're also going to talk about evil and suffering, the problem of the Bible. We're going to answer Bible contradiction, God's existence, problem of science, some of the stuff we like to talk about.
Right.
So, not that we don't like to talk about sex. But all right, come on out to Revolution Church.
Jeff, you do.
Yeah, of course I do.
Yeah, I can't stand
Dave. I don't let Dave. All right, we're going to be right back after this break. Come on out to Revolution Church.
Do you love Truth Revolution?
Of course they do, Dave.
Well, if you do, or...
Or if you appreciate the fact that thousands of people are being taught that Christianity is compatible with science and logic.
Or if you simply love the fact that we hear from people often who say, "This show changed my life. I love Jesus."
Then consider a donation.
You can visit truthrevolution.tv or Revolution Church and donate.
We don't get paid from this show.
But it's our goal to give truth, give knowledge, give encouragement.
And your giving keeps all of our giving going.
Why should you go to church?
You know, Jesus said we should be the church.
But before then, the word church was used for business meetings. If you were there, you're part of the church because you were doing the work.
Jesus didn't say, "Hey everyone, show up for an hour and hang out."
Not at all. He said, "Be my church."
Meaning, if you follow me, you should get together with other people who follow me and work together. So church is us coming together to do God's work together.
www.revo.church.
That's revo.church.
Truth Shots from TruthRevolution.tv and Revolution Church. Here's your host, Dave, and Pastor Jeff.
It's been asked, how could the God of the entire universe force everyone to believe in one little guy named Jesus?
Right, and everyone has to believe in that one guy from 2,000 years ago among billions of people. How could God do that? It's ridiculous, they say.
Well, what's more ridiculous? To believe that God chose to do things his own way?
Or to believe that God has to do things in a way that you expect?
This objection to the faith isn't a logical objection. It's an emotional one.
That's right. It means, I don't like that God may have said, you have to believe in Jesus.
The important question still remains.
Yeah.
Did God say that or not? Do we have to believe in Jesus?
And when we examine the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus and the prophecies told far in advance
and in detail,
we're led to the conclusion that,
yeah, this is the way God chose to do it.
TruthRevolution.tv.
Do you know, or are you, a woman between 18 and 22 aging out of foster care or without a place to live?
If your goal is to continue your education, whether it's a college degree or GED, the Hope House may be the place for you.
Located in Salina, Kansas, Hope House is a beautiful home, providing not only a place to live, but a place to grow.
As a program of the Ashby House, Hope House provides dedicated volunteers and staff members who are there to help you accomplish your goals.
If this sounds like it might be a place for you or someone you know, please visit hopehouseks.org.
That's hopehouseks.org.
Why should you go to church? Part 2.
You probably have a lot of people in your life who you care about and they care about you.
But imagine that relationship being God-focused. Not just talking theoretically about them once in a while, but seriously.
Both of you loving God more, asking each other, "Hey, what did you learn last week?" And challenging each other because you know that you can both be what God wants you to be.
That's part of what churches do.
Come on out to Revolution Church.
www.revo.church.
That's revo.church.
Truth Revolution.
And we're back. We're talking about, hey, the problem of God.
Yep.
You know, atheists out there, skeptics out there, got a problem with God. Let's try and figure out how we can work through that rather than beating each other over the head, right?
That's right. Here with Mark Clark, the author of The Problem of God, which is available right now on Amazon. Mm-hmm. You can also go to his website. We're going to link to it at truthrevolution.tv. Truthrevolution.tv. So you want to get there, you want to check it out. But Mark Clark grew up in an atheistic home. He, through reason and rationale, found God, wrote this book, The Problem of God. Mark, go ahead. We've talked about hypocrisy. We've talked about sex. Let's talk a little bit about hell. This is something a lot of people, they avoid thinking about. They don't want to talk about it. This is a problem for them. They don't want to believe in a God who would torture people in literal fires for all eternity.
Right.
So what's going on?
Right. Well, this one for me is, as it is for probably most people, it's a personal question because my dad actually passed away when I was 15, and he wasn't a Christian. Mm. And so he actually never even called me and told me he was sick. He was 47 years old, and the hospital called and said, "Your dad just died."
Oh, my goodness.
So there I am at his funeral, asking these massive questions about life and meaning and existence and destiny. And so this is a very personal question for me. This isn't some hypothetical deal. Assuming that, you know, I hope he came to know Jesus, but assuming that he didn't, that he actually, my own father would be there. So of course, my inclination is to say it's not real. But what I found is this issue is less a thing that people say, "Hey, I've got a lot of logical reasons why I shouldn't believe in it." And it's more a repulsion.
Yeah.
But just because something's a repulsion doesn't, just because it doesn't feel good to us doesn't mean it's not true. There's a lot of things that I have to do in my job that don't necessarily feel good, but they're the right calls to make. Firing someone, for instance, or something. It's like, okay, this doesn't feel good, but it's still something I got to do. And so the question is it true? Is it actually legitimate? And if I was making up Christianity or religion, it might not be, but I have to deal with the authority of the Bible and actually get my theology from scripture, and you can't get around it. So Jesus teaches on it and talks about it. And so for me, logically, it actually makes sense, because we all desire justice, whether it's someone cutting in line or genocide. You know, I find that the only people who really don't like the idea of hell are Westerners sitting around Starbucks drinking lattes saying, I don't like the idea of a God of justice and wrath and judgment.
Yeah.
But you go anywhere around the world to that village in Africa where this group of guys just came in and raped and killed the women and children and left without getting any vengeance. And what they're going to tell you is, I don't want to worship a God if there is no hell, if there is no wrath, if there is no judgment.
Yeah.
Why is he worth worshiping if Hitler and Stalin and everybody sitting around heaven holding hands, you know, singing, that's not a legitimate thing.
Right.
And so what we got to deal with is how much of this issue, this repulsion, is just ethnocentricity of, we live in a modern world, we live in the suburbs, we don't like the idea of hell, versus the rest of the world that actually goes, if there's no God of judgment and justice here, I don't even want to believe in him. He's not worth worshiping.
Yeah.
And so I had to check my presuppositions and go, am I actually just kind of in an echo chamber of the West? And that's true about all the questions in the book. Have you deduced things about the world just because you're sitting around in the suburbs?
Yeah.
At a Starbucks. And do you know how scary that is?
Major worldview shift when you get outside there.
Major worldview shift.
Yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, the other thing about hell, that just as you're talking, I realize, and sometimes I think about this, the very same people who will say, you know, hell is not fair, are often the same type of skeptics who will say, if God is real and powerful, why doesn't he do something about all the evil in the world? I'm like, you know, you can't ask both of those questions at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And actually, you know, Miroslav Volf talks about the idea that the idea of hell or the idea of justice and vengeance being taken out by God is actually the only way that we can be people of nonviolence in the present world.
Yeah.
Under, because he says theologizing violence is the only way to not actually take it on yourself. That's if you believe God's going to do the vengeance thing in Romans 12, then you don't have to retaliate in the present.
That's
because
right.
you know justice is going to be dealt with.
That's exactly right. When Jesus says to love your enemies, I can do that, and I don't have to worry about the consequences because I know God's going to take care of that situation.
Amen. Yeah, so that's part of it. Of course, then, like you said, the burning and the fire, the book gets into it. Apocalyptic literature, I don't know how literal flames will be actually involved. Of course, fire's an image of the Bible, of judgment, of that kind of stuff. But as Tim Keller points out, just even if we said the fire is some type of symbolic apocalyptic thing, it doesn't mean that it's going to be easier. It might mean that it's worse, because he says a symbol, you know, and the image I give in the book, I think, is of a, if you're walking in a mall and you see one of those yellow signs and there's a guy slipping, you might go, oh, that looks brutal. But then if you actually slip and crack your head, it's worse.
Right. Worse than the symbol.
Yeah. So the symbol is actually just a pointer to something that's far worse. Some kind of an emotional, psychological, physical separation from God. And the minute we lose that because we're afraid of, you know, we just want God to be this palpable, you know, daft old uncle who plays chess and hangs out with everybody.
Yeah.
I think we're missing something. I think the world needs to see those, you know, both sides of God. And I think it's a real thing that we can't abandon. So, and I think it's completely logical. I think, you know, what I talk about in the book is Jesus talks about there's going to be people who get different levels of judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's part of what God's deal is. So the regular Joe non-Christian is not going to actually, I mean, it's going to be awful, don't get me wrong, but it's not the exact same level of judgment as the, you know, the Hitlers of the world and so on. And almost every judgment passage in the Bible, whether it's John 5 or Revelation 21 or Romans 2 or whatever it is, constantly talks about he's going to deal out death and judgment based on what we did. constantly comes back to that.
Yes.
And I think that's the reason for it. It's not going to be just the same for everyone.
That's right. We are allowed into the presence of God based on the forgiveness that Jesus Christ offered through his death on the cross and resurrection. But we are judged after that based on our deeds. So,
amen.
Hey, you know, this discussion right here reminds me of the Bible contradiction for today. So let's go ahead and do a Bible contradiction.
All right.
Bible contradiction.
All right, today's Bible contradiction brought to you by 1001BibleContradictions.com.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
great.
Jesus taught resistance, or was it non-resistance?
Okay.
So John 2, 15 and 16 says, "So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables."
So he was pretty upset.
Right. And so Matthew 5, 39 through 40 says, "I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well."
Yeah, we can just go through all sorts of things in Matthew chapter 5 and elsewhere.
Which one of these guys is the real Jesus?
Yeah, the violent one or the non-violent one? Okay, well, we use our CRACT acronym.
Okay.
And the letter D stands for?
Dialect.
What types of words are being used here? What types of teaching is given? Let me just ask you, which one of these was teaching and which one of these was just telling us what Jesus did? All right, the Matthew chapter 5 one was Jesus telling us what to do. Okay, that was a teaching. We are supposed to not resist the evil people. We're supposed to turn to the other cheek. We're supposed to love our enemies. When you get into John chapter 2, this wasn't an example for us to follow.
Right.
Now, this is Jesus being God inside the temple. And, okay, as a parent, I can say something to my six-year-old child. I can say, "Do not drive the car," to my six-year-old child. But it's perfectly acceptable for me to drive the car, right?
Right.
Jesus, as God, the judge of the universe, who's going to put people in hell, has every right to knock over some tables inside the Jewish temple.
Right. He could have done much worse to them, by the way, being God.
And he still would have been right. He could have just eliminated everybody. But this is where he was supposed to be worshipped. But instead, they were using their tables to rip off poor people, right? So he knocked over their tables. I don't have that right.
Right.
God in the Old Testament has the right to tell Israel to go to war. I don't have that right.
Absolutely.
You know those WWJD bracelets? Mm-hmm. What would Jesus do?
Right.
You don't always get to do what Jesus will do.
Right.
That's I don't know. Hey, Mark, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's prescriptive texts and descriptive texts.
Yes.
And some of them are telling you to do stuff and some of them aren't. And it's hard hermeneutically to figure out sometimes where the Bible's saying, hey, you got to do this, you got to do that versus, you know. So I think going to the teachings of Jesus is, very, very smart move.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's good distinction.
Thanks. And, you know, when we look at Jesus giving a teaching, I mean, that's about as crystal clear as you can get in Scripture. I mean, He's pretty darn clear. You know, love your enemies. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to the other. You know, we're not one of these churches that says, oh, this is metaphorical.
Right.
Like, well, I mean, we literally take
and
that.
Another point to bring up, really honestly, I mean, are you a money changer or are you the poor people that the money changer was basically getting over on? Jesus was defending the weak here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's his personality.
That is exactly right. All right, great. That's the answer for Bible contradiction today.
Bible contradiction.
All right, back to it. All right, Mark. So let's talk about another part of your book here. We're getting up towards the end. We got about another 30 seconds in the radio, but can you stick with us for the podcast for another 5 or 10 minutes?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, great. Just give us a sentence or two on the problem of science. Okay, the problem of science. What was your issue there?
Well, just the general idea that science has disproven God and we don't need God anymore because we've advanced. And the book shows, no, actually, as science gets deeper into cosmology and biology, it's actually the hints of a creator and a God and a mind that transcends nature are actually becoming more and more legitimate. And actually saying, no, God has actually been hinted at through cosmology and the implication of DNA, all that stuff. So it's actually
opposite. So the discovery of DNA, the discovery that our universe was 15 billion years old, this doesn't make God irrelevant. We're going to talk about why not. You got to get to the podcast or the YouTube channel if you're listening.
Makes it more relevant.
That's right. Yeah. So, all right.
Yeah, which is why Leslie Newbegin said there's more atheists in the humanitarian disciplines in a university than the sciences.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Hey, truthrevolution.tv. We're going to be right back. If you're listening to the podcast, if you're listening on the radio or on TV,
got
to
skip over.
Got to get over to truthrevolution.tv or look it up on your podcast software and then come out to Revolution Church. You've been listening to the show for a while now. Mm-hmm. Just give it a shot.
You know you want to.
Just wear whatever you're wearing right now, as long as you're wearing something. And just come on out to Revolution Church. We'd love to have you. Check our revo.church for our service times.
Truth Revolution.
We are on the podcast.
All right. It's time to podcast. All right. So the problem of science, you were talking about this, actually all these details that we've learned makes God more relevant, not less relevant. So,
right.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, just the people think, okay, we've got so much technological advancement, we don't need God anymore as an explanation. And so I talk about in the book the fact that, you know, the Big Bang, for instance, as you referenced, like when we, you know, Aristotle, Plato, all those guys used to talk about contingency and that the fact that if something began to exist, it had to have a cause. So everyone would say, well, what's that thing that never began to exist? And all the philosophers would say, well, that's the universe. The universe has always existed. It has no need for anything outside of it to create it. Until Edwin Hubble looked through his telescope and went, no, actually, the universe began to exist.
Right.
15 billion years ago, all matter, time, energy, space came into existence in a single moment. So if that's true, now we're pushed back to, okay, the universe began to exist. Well, the universe therefore needs a cause, and it can't be matter. It has to be mind. And of course, Jesus taught that God is spirit. So he transcends nature. And so the origins of the universe hint for a need for actually something that exists outside of it to make it.
Yeah.
And so that's been a huge thing. Biology, the more we've looked into, I mean, Darwin during his day was doing observational science. He was cracking open, you know, birds and looking at stuff with microscope.
Yeah.
That's great. He didn't have a DNA. Mm-hmm. He wasn't looking into the amount of information in a DNA strand going, oh my goodness, this is 30 encyclopedias full of information.
Yeah.
Right.
What's going on here? There had to be a mind. And it's not random information. It's intelligent information. So the deeper we go, the more rational God actually becomes in the context of science. So I show that in the book, that it's doing the opposite to what everyone thought it would do 60, 70 years ago.
That's awesome. And again, this book is The Problem of God, available right now on Amazon, or you can hop over to his website. Just go to truthrevolution.tv. We'll link to it. Great stuff there. Let's talk about the problem of the Bible. Presumably, you did grow up in an atheist home. Was a Bible present there when you were growing up?
No. Never was exposed to the Bible.
What was your thought about the Bible before you became a Christian?
Well, I just thought it was old stories of made up, you know, crazy stories of miracles. And it wasn't modern. It wasn't like a legit thing. It was this old ancient thing full of fairy tales.
And what changed your mind?
Looking at it, doing the research, understanding. I mean, for a while, it was interesting. Before I ever walked into a church, my first interaction was with the Bible. And what I found there, as Augustine said, was, you know, he said, the Bible is the face of God for us now. And it's like, there is something in the power of reading the Bible for me, for the skeptics out there, like push aside, read the Bible. It's actually God uses it to speak in a crazy way. So my first interaction was God actually meeting me in the pages of the Bible and speaking truth and power into my life. And then I started researching, like, is this legitimate? And just started looking at the historical stuff. And so I include all that in the book, comparing the manuscripts to different manuscripts at the time and why Old Testament and New Testament scholars say that the New Testament and the Old Testament together is the most trusted stuff in antiquity, like the most trusted writing, more than all the stuff that we trust.
Right.
By way of the amount of manuscripts, how soon after it was written. You know, you read these skeptical books and they're like, you can't trust the Bible. It was written 50 years after the events. It's like 50 years in the scope of antiquity. That's like a tweet.
Right.
That's like right in the present moment, because all these books are written 500 years after the events and we don't question them.
Yep.
And then literally we have these things written 30, 40 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus, where constantly they're citing names of people. They're saying, hey, look at Alexander and Rufus, and hey, go talk to these 500. These were the eyewitnesses of the resurrection, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. Go and ask them. And what scholars point out is these documents, none of these stories, if they were made up, ever would have been accepted, and they never would have got traction because everyone who was still alive when they were being passed around would have said, that didn't happen.
Yes.
Those 2,000 pigs weren't drowned.
That's
he never fed 5,000. He never did this, and it never would have gotten any traction. But the fact that it did, what you do if you want to make up a story is you got to wait till all the eyewitnesses are dead,
gone,
and then you can make up whatever you want.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So, and then, of course, there's all the counter, as Tim Keller talks about, and I cite him in this chapter a few times, where the counterproductive content in the Gospels, where if you and I were coming up with a religion and going, we want Jesus to look perfect, we want the disciples to look great, blah, blah, blah. It's a total fail because Jesus is questioning himself on the cross. He's talking to himself. Why have you forsaken me? It's like, I just spent 16 chapters trying to convince you he's God. And now he's talking to himself and he's sweating in the garden. He's saying he doesn't want to do it. And then people come up to him and they say, do you know when you're coming back? And he's like, I don't have a clue. And they're like, but aren't you God? Aren't you all knowing? Oh yeah, I know everything. So when are you coming back? I don't know. It's like, this is counterproductive information. Just erase this stuff. Whitewash it. Don't put it in there. But they keep it in there. And scholars say it's because it just kind of happened.
Yeah. It's like they're actually telling a real story.
Right. Eyewitness news.
Like, that's right.
Like if the three of us were trying to see, here's what's fascinating to me when I started reading this stuff. If the three of us were trying to create a religion, here's what we wouldn't do. We'd say, okay, Dave, okay, Jeff, you write your gospels. I'm going to write mine. But let's make sure that there's the same amount of angels at the tomb that talk.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So how many are we going to go with, guys?
Exactly.
Two or one? And we'd go, okay, one. And then we'd all, but you read the Gospels, one of them's got one of them's got two. It's like the fact that, and of course they're not contradictions as you guys have talked about. It's just one of them's telling us how many of them spoke and the other one's just telling us how many were there. Yeah. But
well, and I don't know if you've done work with Jane Warner Wallace or not, Cold Case Christianity, but he talks a lot about how having different witness accounts where they're just a little bit different than each other actually lends a lot of credibility to the story.
Yeah, 100%.
He says he's a detective, and if he ever interviewed three people and they gave an identical story, he'd
be like,
they're lying.
Thumbs up. They created this. Yeah. I mean, that's the beautiful part of the Gospels. So those kind of credibilities, it's like there's a reason scholars really trust it.
And certainly, if we were going to make up our own religion, I would hope to make one up that got us rich, not one that got us ostracized and then killed. Right?
Got my fingernails pulled out and burned at the stake.
Yeah, I'm going to try to avoid
eaten by
that.
Lions.
good. All right, so let's talk a little bit now about God's existence. And, you know, we'll spend a couple minutes on this and then wrap it up. Again, this is the Problem of God by Mark Clark. So the Problem of God's Existence. This is one we talk about a lot, but what do you have to say about in your book?
Well, I talk about two or three major arguments. One of them is the scientific beginning of the universe. The other one is the moral law. That was huge for me when I started reading just the idea of, I know, why do we all agree that dropping napalm on babies is wrong? Why do we all agree that rape is wrong? And we wouldn't, if nature, if there was a pure evolutionary explanation for our morality, our cognitive faculties got wired purely by hundreds of thousands of years of our grandparents making decisions, then we've deduced things that are contrary to that, because killing the youngest in the litter is actually very helpful for us. But we, of course, go, well, that's wrong. That's, you can't just go, you know, kill a bunch of your young. You have five children. You're like, oh, that one looks a little slow. I'm going to throw them in the garbage. We don't do that. But why? If our cognitive faculties were purely hardwired into our brain by the choices we had to make to survive, then we wouldn't think anything of genocide. It'd be like, of course, you know, take the weak among us and make them slaves.
Yeah.
Who cares? That's not a big thing. But somehow we have a morality that transcends nature. And where did it come from? Why do I know that you know, breaking in line is wrong? Why do my kids go, you know, you jumped on the trampoline yesterday, so I get to jump on the trampoline. Who taught them this sense of justice? Where did we get
from
all this stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so that, if you have a moral law among a species, and you have to, you know, like humankind, then you have to have a moral law giver. Who decided what right? And when I'm sitting there looking at my father's, you know, casket, and I'm saying to myself, something about this doesn't just feel sad. It feels like almost wrong. Like it's disjointed. What am I comparing that to?
Yes.
Some kind of way it's supposed to be.
That's right.
Where's that?
That's exactly
right. It's just us. If it's just nature, red and tooth and claw, I got nothing to compare this to.
That's right.
So somewhere in my, you know, as Paul talks about in Romans 2, it's because God hardwired that into our minds to actually seek him out. And so the idea of the beginning of the universe, the idea of the moral law, these are things that, you know, we definitely have to wrestle with and go, these are actually pointers to the existence of God.
That's awesome. All right. Hey, Mark, thanks so much for being on the show today. This has been awesome.
Bro, thanks. Good. Thanks for having me, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. I hope everybody goes and gets your book, The Problem of God. As you can tell, Mark's super intelligent guy. It's going to be a great book on Amazon. Go to truthrevolution.tv. We're going to link right to him. Thanks again for joining us. It's been great.
Cool. Thank you.